O Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
O
Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
O Namo
Vasudevaya. Srimad Bhagavatam, first canto, chapter 11. Lord Krishna's entrance into Dwarka, text 6. Natasmate natha sadhangri pankajam. Varincha vairincha surendra vanditam. Parayanam chayamam ahichcha tamparam.
Parayanam chayamam
Nayatra kala prabhavet para prabhu. Nata.
Bow down.
Smuk. We have done so.
Tay.
Unto you.
Nata.
O Lord. Sada,
always.
Angri pankajam,
the
lotus feet.
Vincha,
Brahma, the first living being. Vairincha, sons of Brahma like Sanaka and Sanata.
Sura Indra,
the king of heaven. Vanditam, worshipped by. Parayanam,
the
supreme.
Chayam,
welfare. Eha,
in this life.
Ichchatam,
one who so desires.
Param,
the highest.
Na,
never.
Yamcha,
wherein.
Kala,
inevitable time.
Prabhavet
can exert its influence.
Pada,
transcendental.
Prabhu,
the Supreme Lord.
Translation. The citizens said, O Lord, you are worshipped by all demigods like Brahma, the four suns, and even the King of Heaven. You are the ultimate rest for those who are really aspiring to achieve the highest benefit of life. You are the supreme transcendental Lord, and inevitable time cannot exert its influence upon you. Purport. The Supreme Lord is Sri Krishna, as confirmed in Bhagavad Gita, Brahma Sangita, and other authorized Vedic literatures. No one is equal to or greater than him. And that is the verdict of all scriptures. The influence of time and space is exerted upon the dependent living entities, who are all parts and parcels of the Supreme Lord. The living entities are predominated Brahma, whereas the Supreme Lord is the predominating absolute. As soon as we forget this clear fact, we are at once in illusion and are thus And thus we are put into threefold miseries, as one is put into dense darkness. The clear consciousness of the cognizant living being is God consciousness, in which one bows down unto him in all circumstances. Om again. Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadara Saraswati Guru Bhaktivedanta. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. This first canto of Srimad Bhagavatam is, in a very, shall we say, modest way, introducing you to meeting and separation with Krishna. Of course, that subject matter is much more intense and involved when you approach the 10th canto, the smiling face of the Lord. But even in this first canto, you are being introduced to the ecstasies of impending separation from Krishna and the joy of meeting with Krishna again. Of course, this meeting and separation with Krishna is most extraordinarily demonstrated by Krishna himself when he comes as his own devotee, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who emphasized and demonstrated that the feelings of separation, Vraha Bhava, are even more intense than the feelings of meeting with Krishna. So, those who are following in the footsteps of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu always stress the separation side. From the material point of view, that may seem quite mysterious. Who wants to be separated from the beloved? And of course, actually in that state of Viraha Bhava, love of Krishna in separation, it's not that the devotee wants to be separated from Krishna. It's just that in that bhava of separation, the devotee actually is tasting Krishna's presence more intensely. This is the mystery of love of Krishna. In this first canto, you are being introduced to that. Krishna's departure from Hastinapur. You have Queen Kunti's prayers. Are you leaving us, Lord? Do you think everything is all right now? I don't think so. We still have problems. You may see it that the battle Kurukshetra is over and everything is fine, but I don't see it in that way. I see that there are still many inimical kings around, and they'll cause problems. So we have been through so many calamities, and you've rescued us again and again from each calamity. But now, let's focus on the real calamity. That's your leaving. So Queen Kunti makes her famous prayer that let the other so-called calamities, they can happen all the time, I don't care. But we want to prevent the real calamity, which is your leaving us. So this prayer by Queen Kunti just flips over our conceptions. We think, let us approach the Supreme to relieve us of material calamities. No one wants distress. And we think we have our needs that the Supreme should fulfill. Here we have Kunti Devi repudiating material nature. Ah, those calamities of material nature, I don't care. If by those calamities of material nature Krishna is present, then let there be so many calamities of material nature, because we want the real wealth, the real treasure, the real jewel, which is Krishna's presence. So Queen Kunti is saying, I don't care about the movements of the material energy. I'm just noticing what brings your presence. And if calamities bring your presence, then let the calamities come. So right in the first canto, our conceptions are just flipped over. Let the calamities come again. What kind of organization have I joined? What kind of yoga am I taking up? I want freedom from distress. I need things. I want things. And I'm just hoping, waiting and hoping, wishing and hoping that Krishna is going to fulfill my needs. Otherwise, what am I doing here? Actually, we are here to fulfill Krishna's needs. But Krishna has no needs. Again, another mysterious paradox. Why am I worried about serving someone who doesn't need to be served? Why am I concerned about satisfying the desires of someone who is self-sufficient in satisfying his own desires? Of course, the tattva, the truth, is that we are part of Krishna. And it is our constitutional nature simply to harmonize with Krishna through service. It's not that Krishna gains from from our service. We gain. It's our nature to be pure lovers of Krishna. Anything else is a deviation and causes us so much distress. So it's not that we're doing Krishna a favor by serving him. No, we're simply doing ourselves a favor. And Krishna mercifully accepts our little service, even though he doesn't need it. So many examples, you know, of children doing something, a little something for their parents, even though the parents could have done it more quickly and more thoroughly themselves. But they were pleased by the child's attempt at devotion. Indeed, it is devotion that is the essential reality. Everyone can appreciate that. Devotion is such an essential reality that Krishna himself, the Supreme Ishwar, as stated in this verse, the Nata, the controller, the Prabhu, the Supreme Master, even he agrees to come under the control of devotion. This is how powerful the devotional reality is. Krishna, who doesn't need anything, yet comes under the control of his devotees' love, voluntarily. It's not exactly that Krishna is submitting to the devotee. No, he's submitting to the devotee's love. Krishna relishes that. I think I told you this story before, how once I was waiting at the Melbourne airport for a plane at the gate, and there were about 50 people waiting, sitting down, or some were standing. And there was a family, obviously a very well-to-do businessman, and he had his wife and two little children with him. And they were sitting down. And then the little girl, she would stand up. She was about 4 years old, and she would point to the floor. "Down, Daddy, down!" And the father would get up off of his chair and fall on the floor. And the little girl would laugh with delight, and the father would get up and sit down. And 2 minutes later, "Down, Daddy, down!" And again, the father would fall on the floor. On his back. This is an airport, you know. He's obviously a well-to-do businessman, but this just went on for 10 minutes. And all the people, 50 or 60 people, were just watching and smiling. So what does that show you? It shows you that they appreciate that there is a higher reality than just formalities, stiffness, awe and reverence. No, they just see this loving father. Just see he's conquered by his daughter's love. And so much so that in a public place he'll just fall on the floor repeatedly on his back at the command of his little daughter. So everyone can appreciate that. So why deny this in Krishna? Krishna relishes coming under the control of his devotee's love. And to intensify that love, Krishna arranges scenes of meeting and separation. And you're getting that right in the first canto. In this first canto, you get a hint that actually Krishna, while in Mathura and Dwarka, would, shall we say, sneak back to Vrindavan. You get just a hint in the first canto. He's present there in Vrindavan in his bhava presence. His presence generated by the pure love of the Brijvasis. And that bhava presence is actually more intense than his so-called physical presence. These are the mysteries of bhakti. So you get that hint right in the first canto. So, Krishna departs from Hastinapur, and the impending separation provokes Queen Kunti's prayers. Everything has prospered because of you. Because of your presence, because of your lotus feet touching the earth, because of your glance on material nature, everything is flourishing. But if you leave, all the essence will just depart. Kevayam namarupabhyam yarubhisaha param. Just like the name and fame of the body disappears, it ends upon the spirit soul leaving the body. Oh, you may say, well, it lasts for a while, but it's such a short time. When the spirit soul leaves, the most important thing has left the body. So similarly, when you leave Krishna, we'll all be finished. And then at the end of Queen Kunti's prayers, Yudhisthira, he implores Krishna, my dear Krishna, please stay a few days longer in Hastinapur. And Krishna submits to Yudhisthira's request. Not simply because Yudhisthira is in the role of Krishna's older cousin, but because of his pure love. Eventually Krishna does leave Hastinapur. And you've heard in the previous chapter, the scene caused how the ladies would get up on the rooftops and look down upon Krishna. That's a sign of culture and respect. Not like these days, everyone just gets right up in one another's face. No, the ladies were up on the roofs of the palaces looking down at Krishna. And they knew he's leaving. They're checking their tears because they are thinking, oh, tears are inauspicious. Of course, there's nothing inauspicious about their tears. They're tears of impending separation from Krishna. Yet the devotee is always thinking, what is best for Krishna? So they're thinking, these ladies watching from the palace rooftops, they're thinking that we don't want to create an inauspicious departure for Krishna, so we'll check our tears. Even though, actually, their tears were of pure love. So this shows us how we really should approach devotional service. We're trying to give pleasure to Krishna. And the sooner that we get off of our selfish trip, the better. Because it's not making us happy. This constant calculation. What's in it for me? What am I getting from this? What are you doing for me? How do I feel? It's actually so miserable. Who here can say that they are happy being like that? It's amazing how by directly pursuing happiness, you're not happy. This is another mystery of existence. We were speaking about this last night. How the general conception is that happiness is out there. You just have to grab it. You have to be acquisitive. You have to be achievement-oriented. In fact, you have to be greedy. It's out there. Others are getting it. You're not getting it. We also explained this at a retreat a couple of weekends ago here. This is the predominating notion in our in our consciousness. Happiness is just yours for the taking, and the world owes it to you. You just got to grab it. You have to be keen, you have to be ready, you have to be alert to grab happiness. Any way you can. If you can buy it, great. If you can't buy it, rent it. Somehow, if you can't rent it, steal it. Just manipulate, organize, administrate, manage your way to happiness. This is the religion of the consumer society. Consume and you'll be happy. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna gives the prerequisites before you can even think about happiness. And of course, bhakti is beyond the happiness trip, the selfish approach to happiness. But first, if you want to think about happiness in the conventional way, there's some requirements, some prerequisites that you have to meet. So Krishna says, first of all, you need transcendental knowledge. With transcendental knowledge, you can steady your mind. Oh, and what's the possibility of steadying your mind with material knowledge or material stimulation? You've experienced that so many lifetimes. You tried to steady your mind this way and that way, and finally you just gave up on it. Oh, anyway, steady mind. What's the financial value of a steady mind? What's the interest rate on a steady mind? Does anyone When you apply for the university or apply for a job, do they ask if you have a steady mind? It's just totally not valued. Even when some of you were considering marrying each other, did you ask the potential partner, do you have a steady mind? No, you didn't. You were considering other factors. So, a steady mind is not considered a necessity these days. It's not even considered beneficial. But Krishna explains that first, transcendental knowledge. With transcendental knowledge, you can have a hope for having a steady mind. Because transcendental knowledge teaches you not simply that you're not the body, you're not the mind, but it teaches you that you're part of Krishna, meant to give Krishna pleasure. So just that knowledge alone helps you to have a steady mind. You see, ordinary knowledge of self-realization is actually considered external from the standpoint of Srimad Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita. Simply to understand you're not the body and mind is considered external knowledge, even though it's knowledge of self-realization. The knowledge becomes internal or transcendental, Divya Gyan, when it includes your positive identity, not simply what you are not, but it includes your identity as part of Krishna, and you're meant to engage in Krishna's service. Your forgotten constitutional nature. So with transcendental knowledge, you can steady your mind, because your mind will no longer be seeking material fulfillment. It won't be subject to the material aches and pains. So, transcendental knowledge, steady mind. Then Krishna says, you can have peace. Peace doesn't simply mean like political peace or economic peace or no class warfare or no ethnic clashes, no domestic fights at home. Peace means that you are not being capsized by material desires. And most importantly, that you are engaged in Krishna's service. That is the anchor for your mind, Krishna's service. So, transcendental knowledge, steady mind, then peace. And Krishna says, without peace, how is there any chance for happiness? So you've got three things you have to deal with before you can even think about happiness. Now, what do you say about that? Oh, too much. I'm sure that you can just grab happiness. Just grab a handful of happiness. You can just convince someone, make me happy. Come on, make me happy. And when they no longer are suitable, you just toss them out. You're not making me happy anymore. Out you go. Like a soda can after you finish drinking. Throw it out. Nothing. No more. No more soda. Throw the can out, crush it to make more room in the waste container. We approach relationships with this consumerist mentality. We become such hedonists, but we don't understand that. So, you meet those prerequisites, and then you can think about happiness. But real happiness is not about trying to please yourself. As one becomes elevated in bhakti, you begin to distinctly taste that real pleasure is simply thinking about Krishna's pleasure. This is the Vrindavan mood. In Srila Prabhupada's books, you are presented with the ecstasy, the highest ecstasy, which is simply how to give Krishna pleasure. Sometimes persons may complain. Well, there's nothing in Prabhupada's books about how we're going to be ecstatic. Because these books are pure devotional books. They're all focused on how to give Krishna pleasure. Is that a fault? If you simply focus on how to give Krishna pleasure, the mystery of bhakti is that you'll automatically be happy. You don't have to worry about it. So these books, Srila Prabhupada's books, are the no-worries books about happiness.
They don't talk about your own happiness. And sometimes devotees feel uncomfortable about it.
What about me?
I keep reading these books over and over again, and going to the Bhakti Shastri, Bhakti Vaibhav classes. And now it's been a few years. What about me? I know what I need. I need to go to a contemporary psychology course about the art of happiness for me. Yes, yes, that's what's missing. I need to take up some new psychological techniques for focusing on my own happiness. Oh, this bhakti stuff, it gets to be too much, you know. Everything for Krishna, Krishna, Krishna. I need something more direct. This is what Maya tells. You need something more direct because serving Krishna is indirect. But how can you please yourself directly? It's impossible. Only in Maya is the conception there. The possibility is only existing in illusion. Okay, now I'm going to make myself happy. As if you're separate from Krishna. So you forget about Krishna and you just see yourself. Yeah, me and my wants and needs. Yeah, that's it then. Now we're getting practical. And so that's how people evaluate their life. In a nice, genteel way or a very rough and gross way. Basically they're saying, how am I feeling? What's in it for me? So we may feel a little uncomfortable due to our material conditioning that where is the direct course for my own happiness? The Bhagavatam is not presenting that. And you're right. In the very beginning, Srimad Bhagavatam says, Dharma Pojita Kaitavotra Padamona Matsaranam Satam. The first thing it does is sweep out every conception of religiosity, spiritual process, anything that doesn't accept pure devotion as its be-all and end-all. Swept out the door. Pujita. So sometimes this Bhagavatam standard is intimidating due to our material conditioning. But we should not blame the Bhagavatam or blame the bhakti process. We should blame ourselves. I'm being intimidated because I have a lot of material attachments and the Bhagavatam is working on those material attachments. So then I get defensive. Leave me alone. Leave my attachments alone. You get really restless and feisty and I just need some space. I just need my own space from devotional service. Because Krishna is the supreme intense. And rather than surrender to the supreme intensity of Krishna, we'd rather surrender to the intensity of Maya. So, Krishna's departure from Hastinapur was intense. Not as intense as Krishna's departure from Vrindavan previously to go to Mathura. Nothing is that intense. Nevertheless, it was intense, Krishna's departure from Hastinapur. And Kunti Devi, she's in the role of Krishna's aunt. She accepts obeisances from Krishna, even though she knows he's the Supreme Personality Godhead. She offered her prayers, and Yudhisthira, Lord Krishna, please don't go. And the ladies are on top of the roofs, trying to check their tears. It's a scene. Krishna is leaving. Now, in this chapter, Krishna is entering Dwarka, meeting with Krishna. He blows his conch shell, his Divya Shankha, his divine conch shell, which, as he blows into it, it turns red, letting you know that the conch shell is sentient, it's conscious, it's feeling ecstasy because Krishna is blowing it, touching the conch shell to his lips. Of course, in the 10th canto, you read the gopis speaking about Krishna's flute. How does the flute taste the nectar of Krishna's lips? The ancestors of the flute must be so satisfied. But that nectar that the flute is getting is only meant for us. So you see the same principle in a less intense way, demonstrated by the conch shell in Krishna's hand as he enters Dwarka. And you see the residents of Dwarka. When they hear the conch shell, they 100% have the presence of Krishna, because Krishna's sound vibration is not different from Krishna. Just like when we hear the Hare Krishna mantra, that sound vibration is completely Krishna's presence. How do we realize that? By being eager to hear the sound of Krishna. That eagerness makes it quicker to realize what we're dealing with in bhakti, the presence of Krishna. If we watch it when you start to become dull and mechanical, okay, it's time to hear about Krishna. Oh, well, you know, what's the rush? This class every day. It's time to chant Hare Krishna. It's time for kirtan. Oh, kirtans are going on all the time. I need time for my own mind. I need some space to consider me. Why all this rushing to kirtans, rushing to hear about Krishna, rushing to serve Krishna? I need a balanced life. Balanced life means some Krishna and then no Krishna. That's the balance, you see? No, truly balance means you balance your material affairs that are necessary with your direct devotional service. And because your necessary material affairs are supporting a bhakti lifestyle, in that way, even your necessary material affairs can take on a spiritual surcharge. Just like if devotees are exercising and trying to be healthy for the sake of their service, those efforts to exercise and maintain the body take on a spiritual surcharge, because everything is focused on serving Krishna better. So Krishna blew his conch shell, and the residents of Dwarka knew he's here. And they're offering him prayers. Because when you glorify someone, if you quote respectable topmost personalities, that adds impact and meaning to the glorification. That's why, for example, for Prabhupada's Guru Puja, he specified that the senior most person should do the puja, because by the senior person doing it, it adds impact to the puja. So the puja is about giving honor to the person. And so, therefore, when the senior most person does that, it adds to the puja. It's an essential part of the puja. So similarly, when you hear the citizens are quoting, "O Lord, you are worshipped by all demigods like Brahma, the four sunas, and even the king of heaven." So that adds credibility and impact to their greeting, to their prayers. Just see all the topmost personalities who are worshiping you. And we're also doing that. Just like in Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna, he quotes others, Asita, Devala, Vyasa. Asita, Devala Rishi, Vyasadeva, they're all accepting you, Krishna, as from Brahma, from Dhamma, the supreme abode, the supreme destination. Swayam Chaiva Bhavishime, and now I also am doing like that. So this is the proper way to offer honor and respect to someone, by citing the topmost personalities. So please don't take this as just some randomly chosen words. All the citizens are saying, okay, you're worshipped by all the demigods like Brahma, okay. The four sunas, even the king of heaven. This is how our Kali Yuga dull mind operates, I know. What you should be thinking is, they are properly glorifying Krishna. They are quoting the topmost personalities. Just like when you come before the deity, the most recommended way to offer prayers is to recite prayers by the dearest devotees of Krishna. It doesn't mean you can't say anything from your own heart, but at the same time, one should bear in mind that what is most pleasing to Krishna? If you recite the prayers by the most expert lovers of Krishna, the most expert devotees of Krishna, it catches his attention. So this is what the citizens are doing. They're quoting, you see, we're worshiping you, but let's remember, you're worshipped by all demigods, personalities far beyond us. Brahma, Adi Kavi, the original intellectual universe. His sons, the four Kumars. Even Indra, he worships you. Everyone wants to go to heaven in the material sense. But here we see the king of heaven is worshiping you. So this is puja. I was explaining this point at one temple where I was for Janmashtami. And they put all the effort into Janmashtami, and then somehow they forgot to organize Prabhupada's Vyasa Puja. And so Prabhupada's Vyasa Puja was a haphazard, impromptu affair. No one knew what was going on. So I explained to them that, because some of the devotees, you know, they were young and they were thinking, well, we got it together. We threw it together at the last minute. Quite a few times, and no one knew what was going on, and no one was in charge. There was no master ceremonies. But it happened. It happened. What's the problem? Anyway, it was like that last year, too. So, I explained that part of puja is the orderliness, the timeliness, the punctuality, the cleanliness. That's all showing respect. You don't show respect to someone when you throw something together at the last minute. What do we do now? Does anyone know what we're doing now? Oh, Pushpanjali. Flowers? How do you do it anyway? That doesn't show respect and honor to the person. This is personalism. That you want to make your offering very tidy in the external sense. Because, you see, you can't just prematurely be like Sanatana Goswami, who kept his Radha Krishna deities in the tree and giving them dry chapatis, and then the deities say to him, can you at least put some salt on the dry chapatis? We can't immediately jump to that Radha platform. The precursor to that Radha platform is doing devotional service according to rules and regulations. It's well organized, it's tidy, it's prompt. So I was explaining that. Well, similarly, you see the citizens of Dwarka here. They're making a proper presentation to Krishna upon greeting him. You are the ultimate rest for those who are really aspiring to achieve the highest benefit of life. You are the supreme transcendent Lord. The inevitable time cannot exert its influence upon you. So this is properly being a person. This is personalism. They are reciting the factual glories of Krishna. Of course, when Krishna comes back to Vrindavan from the forest in the evening, that's something else. There's no prayers of awe and reverence then. There's just the gopis watching Krishna from the corner of their eyes. All of Vrindavan becomes immersed in a festival when Krishna comes back with the cowherd boys and cows every evening. In fact, during the day, no one in Vrindavan can handle the separation from Krishna. It seems like it's going to be forever until evening comes and Krishna comes back. So the residents of Vrindavan, they often look in the sky to see if the sun is moving to the evening position. oh no, the sun is still high overhead. Oh, it's going to be so long before Krishna comes back. And then they look at the paths to the forest, and they're trying to see if there's any dust clouds appearing on the paths, because the dust clouds indicate the cows and cowherd boys and Krishna are returning. No, they don't see any dust clouds. And then they strain their ears to see if they can catch any sound of Krishna playing the flute in the forest. Sometimes they hear a little faintly, far in the distance, flute sounds. So, this is their consciousness during the day. They're feeling separation from Krishna and the longing to meet Krishna again. Mother Yashoda, she has Nanda Maharaj stand on top of a watch place, a watchtower in their house. Do you see him? Do you see him? Is he coming? Is he coming? And of course, Krishna's gopis, they're thinking, how are his feet feeling? He's walking in the forest barefoot. His feet are being pricked by little stones and sharp grass. Those feet are so soft, we dare not even put them on our chest. But now he's walking barefoot in the forest. So they're just totally focused on how is Krishna feeling. And then when Krishna comes back in the evening, everyone's feelings of separation are relieved. But remember, the feelings of separation are more intense than the feelings of meeting with Krishna. Lord Chaitanya, when he was at the home of Advaita Acharya, they would have kirtan every night. During the day there would be talks about Krishna and feasting, and at night there would be kirtans. And Advaita Acharya would start singing a song. I've got him again in my house. Finally, I've got him again in my house. I'm not going to let him go now. I've got him again in my house. Advaita Acharya is provoking Lord Chaitanya's feelings of separation by quoting songs in the mood of Srimati Radharani. Now Krishna has returned. I'm not going to let him go again. And so when Lord Chaitanya heard those songs of separation, his ecstasy just basically destroyed himself. With transcendental ecstasy. We don't know ecstasy that great that it destroys you. Chaitanya Charitamrita says the ecstasies that would take over the body of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu were like a battle between elephants trampling an entire forest. Different ecstasies all at once would dominate Lord Chaitanya, like different elephants dominating a forest and trampling. So Advaita Acharya would sing in that way. And he and Nityananda and Haridas would dance behind one another while Advaita Acharya is singing. And Lord Chaitanya would also dance. And then, overwhelmed by this mood of separation from Krishna, Lord Chaitanya would hear Mukunda singing songs. And Mukunda, as an expert devotee, he knew Lord Chaitanya is being devastated by songs about separation from Krishna. Now I will sing songs about meeting Krishna just to calm his ecstasies. And so he would sing songs like that. So in this way, the kirtan went on and on and on. And finally, devotees noticed Lord Chaitanya is so fatigued. We should somehow or other end the kirtan. You see, Lord Chaitanya, he was giving the impression that his transcendental body was fatigued because he had dined sumptuously, or he had lunched sumptuously at Advaita Acharya's house. So the devotees knew that. But Lord Chaitanya wasn't aware of that. He was just dancing and leaping, but the devotees could see that because of Advaita Acharya's sumptuous lunch prasad, the Lord is showing symptoms of fatigue. But Lord Chaitanya was not noticing that. So out of service to Lord Chaitanya, the devotees stopped the kirtan. So in Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, you see in a most memorable way, the feelings of separation from Krishna and how the devotees would handle that. Devotees like Sukh Damodar would recite appropriate verses to appeal to various moods of love of Krishna that manifest in Lord Chaitanya. So this is real life. So our question is, when will we ever know that real life? And why do we take our hollow, tinny, mechanical, material existence to be so substantial? This is the miracle of Maya, that it takes what is insubstantial and flickering and makes it seem so predominant and intense and potentially satisfying for us. When we hear the real standard of life, the real standard of living, then naturally, our soul, redevelops the desire to be with Krishna. Yes, this is what I really want. In spite of my material coverings, this is what I really want. And Krishna has a super soul in your heart. He notices that. And he gradually arranges to fulfill your desire. Srimata Sakata Krishna Punya Shravana Kirtana Hridyantastha Vyabhadrani Vidunoti Srit Sata. Krishna does notice. He's in your heart. He's conscious. He's aware of how your desires are developing in relation to him. All right, we'll stop here and ask any questions. Okay, no questions. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.